national anthem and they can't be identified as Russia, that's been canceled. Russia has now been totally thrown out of the World Cup. FIFA has decided they're just, it's just a hard no. And we're going to talk about that and other kind of sports related sanctions that have come in the past and that may come in the future. All of those stories and more are on today's bonus show. How do you get access to the bonus show? Simple. Sign up for a membership at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code. Please don't war. I know it sounds ungrammatical, but that's what it is. The coupon code is please don't war. You'll get a discount off of a membership. You'll get access to the bonus show, the commercial free audio feed, the commercial free video feed, and much, much more. We will see you then and tonight live on YouTube, Twitch, and Facebook for Joe Biden's State of the Union address. I hope you'll join.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT, the in sound from way out. WRCT, the in sound from way out.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth. The cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once-over.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem. One that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.pittsburgh,
meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
6 days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated.
President Biden delivers his first State of the Union as Russia escalates its attacks on Ukraine. We'll go to Kiev for the latest, then hear from a Nigerian student about the racist treatment of Africans trying to flee Ukraine.
We started protesting and telling them they have to let us go, that this is rubbish. They're taking like 100 Ukrainians and then taking like 2 Africans. It doesn't make sense because there are more Africans there than Ukrainians at the border. So we started pushing and the police cocked their guns and pointed their gun and told us that they're going to shoot us.
Plus, we'll speak about Russia's invasion and President Biden's State of the Union with Filipino vice presidential candidate Walden Bello of Focus on the Global South and Branko Marcetic of Jacobin. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia has intensified its attacks on Ukraine's major cities. The governor of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, said at least 21 people were killed and over 100 wounded in a 24-hour period under heavy Russia shelling. The city's police headquarters and university were badly damaged and caught fire. Russia says it captured the southern port city of Kherson, though local officials deny the claim. Mariupol has also come under intense shelling. In the capital, Kiev, a Russian missile strike on a television tower killed 5 civilians Tuesday. The attack also hit the site of Kiev's Babi Yar Holocaust Memorial. The memorial commemorates the more than 33,000 Jews who were shot dead by Nazis and Nazi-led forces over a 2-day period in 1941, and the estimated 100,000 Jews, Roma, and others killed near the site between 1941 and 1943. The memorial was partially funded by one of the Russian billionaires, Mikhail Friedman. President Volodymyr Zelensky attended the 80th anniversary of Babi Yar at the memorial along with world leaders this past September. Zelensky responded to the attack today.
It is beyond humanity. This rocket strike proves that for many people in Russia, our Kyiv is absolutely foreign. They don't know a thing about our capital, about our history, but they all have orders to erase our history, erase our country, erase us all.
Ukrainian President Zelensky added in his comments, quote, "You killed Holocaust victims for the second time." The UN says some 836,000 people have fled Ukraine in the weeks since the invasion began in what, quote, looks set to become Europe's largest refugee crisis this century, unquote. Poland says more than 450,000 people have crossed its border. This is a refugee from Kiev who fled to Romania.
In Ukraine, it's like a hell. We don't know what to do. That's why we cross to another country. So we don't know what would be tomorrow. So we're running. And my husband stays in Ukraine because there's no possibility to cross for man who is under 60 years. So, of course, he stood in Ukraine.
On Tuesday, the UN launched a $1.7 billion aid appeal for Ukraine. We'll also hear from a black student from Nigeria who talks about discrimination against black students and families who are trying to flee Ukraine. Members of the UN General Assembly are voting today on a resolution demanding Russia immediately cease its military assault on Ukraine, condemning Moscow's decision to put its nuclear forces on high alert. On Tuesday, UN diplomats staged a mass walkout as Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov addressed the UN Human Rights Council. Apple is the latest multinational corporation to withdraw business from Russia, halting sales of all its products. Boeing, Exxon, and Ford Motor also announced they're suspending some or all operations involving Russia. At his first State of the Union address, President Biden also announced new U.S. measures against Russia.
And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy. He has no idea what's coming.
President Biden also said the U.S. and international allies will release 60 million barrels of oil from strategic petroleum reserves to curb a surge in gas prices related to the war. On the domestic front, Biden addressed mounting inflation, education, the pandemic, and pledged to support police forces around the country. We'll have more on Biden's speech later in the broadcast. Texans voted in the country's first primary election of 2022 Tuesday, in perhaps the most closely watched race of the night. 28-year-old Jessica Cisneros, an immigration lawyer and progressive Democrat, will head to a May runoff with the incumbent Congressmember Henry Cuellar after neither secured the 50% threshold needed to move forward. Conservative Democrat Henry Cuellar's home and office were raided by the FBI in January as part of a federal investigation. Former labor organizer and Austin City Council member Greg Kassar won the Democratic primary for Congressional District 35. To see our recent interview with Kassar, go to democracynow.org. In the governor's vote, incumbent Greg Abbott won the Republican primary, while former congressmember and presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke clinched the Democratic race. In other news from Texas, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of Texas, and Lambda Legal have filed a lawsuit seeking to block a new Texas law that orders state welfare officials to launch child abuse investigations against parents who seek gender-affirming care for their transgender children, care that is vital and life-saving. The suit was filed on behalf of a family that received a home visit from an investigator last week demanding access to their trans child's medical records. The parents refused. The lawsuit accuses Governor Greg Abbott and the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services of causing terror and anxiety and trampling on the constitutional rights of trans children. In a statement, the ACLU of Texas said, quote, "No family should have to fear being torn apart because they're supporting their trans child." The White House is announcing a new phase in its coronavirus response today. The new strategy will focus on minimizing disruptions to daily life and easing public health measures. It reflects recently updated mask guidance by the CDC and the loosening of restrictions by cities and states around the country. President Biden reflected the shift during the State of the Union address yesterday.
Thanks to the progress we've made in the past year, COVID-19 no longer need control our lives.
Biden also announced a new program to provide people with antiviral treatment as soon as they test positive for COVID. New York City is expected to end some of its mask and vaccine mandates starting next week, including an indoor mask mandate for public school children and the city's main contact tracing program. On the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington announced they're dropping school mask mandates after March 11th. Some health experts, as well as more medically vulnerable populations, have warned against a premature lifting of protective measures. In Canada, the Capuano First nation community has discovered at least 169 potential mass graves on the grounds of the former Gruard Mission Residential School in northern Alberta. Hundreds of other unmarked graves have recently been found at former residential school sites across Canada. An estimated 150,000 Indigenous children attended these boarding schools between the late 1800s and 1990s, funded by the Canadian government and run by the Catholic Church. Children were ripped from their families, sent to the schools, where many were subjected to psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission documented at least 4,100 deaths. In the occupied West Bank, three Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces in two separate attacks Tuesday. The youngest reported death was 18-year-old Shadi Khaled Najm. In other news from the region, Israel's Supreme Court suspended for now the expulsion of four Palestinian families from their homes in the occupied East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Israeli settlers were attempting to seize their land, but the dispute will now have to undergo a legal process that could take years or not be completed at all. Palestinian families have been resisting the dispossession of their homes in Sheikh Jarrah for generations. Panama has enacted a law recognizing the legal rights of nature. Environmentalists are celebrating the legislation as a tool to fight against ecological destruction and the climate crisis. The law defines nature as a unique, indivisible, and self-regulating community of living beings and guarantees nature's rights to conserve its biodiversity and to be restored after it's harmed by human activity. And here in New York City, a 61-year-old woman, Guiying Ma, died 3 months after she was violently attacked in Queens, leaving her comatose and attached to a ventilator and feeding tube. Ma, who came to New York from China 4 years ago, is at least the fourth person of Asian descent to die after a violent attack in New York since December. And Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez blasted House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy for his hollow condemnation of far-right Republicans Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, who both spoke at a white nationalist event over the weekend. The New York Democrat tweeted, quote, "McCarthy has been protecting his little KKK caucus for years with these toothless statements. It's how he covers for them." Ocasio-Cortez reminded her followers that McCarthy, quote, "passionately defended Gosar last year when he reposted a violent animated video showing himself killing AOC and attacking President Biden." AOC added, "he works to protect them." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, as Russia escalates its attack on Ukraine, we go to Kyiv for the latest. Stay with us.
To make this world for all a better place.
This is Your Life by the Commodores. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine has entered its seventh day as Russia intensifies its attack on civilian infrastructure. The Ukrainian government is now saying over 2,000 civilians have been killed in the invasion, though that figure has not been verified. Russia's claiming it seized control of Kherson, a strategic port city on the Black Sea, but local officials are denying the claim. Another port city, Mariupol, is under heavy Russian shelling. Russian paratroopers have stormed Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, where the mayor said shelling has killed at least 21 people and injured 112. Earlier today, a university building in Kharkiv was set ablaze after being hit by a Russian missile. Meanwhile, the massive Russian military convoy is approaching Kiev, Ukraine's capital. A Russian military strike has also hit a TV tower near Kiev. 5 people were killed. The strike also damaged the Babi Yar Holocaust Memorial, which was built to commemorate the more than 33,000 Jews who were shot dead by Nazis and Nazi-led forces over a 2-day period in September 1941, and the estimated 100,000 Jews, Roma, and others killed near the site between 1941 and 1943. That new memorial of Babi Yar was actually funded by one of the Russian billionaires. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky was there in September for the 80th anniversary, along with other leaders around the world. He said Vladimir Putin and Russia are trying to erase Ukraine.
It is beyond humanity. This rocket strike proves that for many people in Russia, our Kyiv is absolutely foreign. They don't know a thing about our capital, about our history, but they all have orders to erase our history, erase our country, erase us all.
President Zelensky is Jewish. The United Nations reports more than 836,000 refugees have now fled Ukraine in what's being described as Europe's largest refugee crisis this century. In Washington, President Biden gave his first State of the Union address and began by focusing on the Russian invasion.
6 days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated. He thought he could roll into Ukraine and the world would roll over. Instead, he met with a wall of strength he never anticipated or imagined. He met the Ukrainian people.
We begin the show today in Kyiv, where we're joined by Andrei Kamenshikov, Ukraine Director for Nonviolence International, Regional Coordinator of the Global Partnership for the Prevention of Armed Conflict. Andrei, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the situation on the ground in Ukraine's capital, in Kyiv, right now, as this convoy of tanks and military supply trucks, some estimate it's as long as 40 miles, makes its way from Belarus, the Russian convoy, to your city?
Yes, hello. Well, as for the situation in Kyiv, the city is of Kyiv. It's a large city. It's a metropolitan area with a total population of probably about 4 million people. And it's an area that is preparing to defend itself. There is evidence that the initial plan of the Russian offensive had in mind taking over Kyiv, I think, on the second or third day of the invasion. And the Russian troops reached the outskirts of the city, but basically were bogged down and were stopped there. And they are still there in the near outskirts on the northwest and northeast of the city. I do not think that there is that the Russian forces have any chance to take over a city of Kyiv in the near future, at least. They might try to surround the city, but even that is questionable whether they will have the capacity to do that. I think some of their greatest losses have been in the area near Kyiv so far.
And Andrei Kremenchukov, how are you and your loved ones staying safe? Could you talk about what the situation is, especially at night in the city in general, in terms of levels of bombardment, to the main areas of Kiev?
It's a big city, and I happen to be lucky, at least so far, in the sense that I live in a southern suburb of the city that has been relatively quiet. The fighting, there has been very heavy fighting, and of course, lots of destruction of property, and I suppose lots of civilian deaths in the areas where this fighting is taking place. That's probably about, if you look, draw a straight line on Google Maps, it's probably about 10, maybe 12, 15 miles from where I'm located. My area has been relatively safe so far. But of course, tensions are high there. People are going along with their lives. I just came from a store. Shelves are half empty. There's still opportunities to buy basic foodstuffs, but for example, I wasn't able to buy any fresh bread for the last few days. However, people are holding out, and I think there is growing confidence that the Russian forces will not be able to take the city.
Were you surprised by the massive extent of this invasion by Putin? Many people had expected that if he did send troops, and it would only be to the Donbas region. But now we're looking at, I mean, after all, Ukraine is the second largest country in territory in Europe after Russia itself. The idea that Putin would even imagine he could occupy and subdue such a large country is really astounding.
Well, first of all, I should agree with you that when I spoke with my friends from the network that I represent, the Global Partnership for Prevention of Armed Conflict, just maybe 3 or 4 days before the invasion began, I mentioned three most likely scenarios. The most likely scenario that I put at maybe 50% was that Russia will try to, as you just mentioned, will try to strengthen the separatist areas in the Donbas and maybe carry out some local offensives in the east of Ukraine, around the Donbas. Second scenario would be that I said would probably be 50% chance, was that Putin would back off and would not invade. And I said that there would be a 20% chance that he would go in with a full invasion on all directions. I saw that as the least likely scenario, even though still, you know, I knew it could happen. And I thought that because I was certain that, and I still am, that this kind of invasion would not bring the desired, would not reach the desired objectives of the invaders, and would have a devastating effect on Russia itself and on Putin's regime eventually as well. But unfortunately, I think that we are dealing with a leadership that is out of touch with reality, that lives in a world of its own fantasies. Putin has been in power for 23 years probably by now, and he surrounded himself with yes men. You know, people don't give him the people that he believes that provide him with information. Provide him with information that he wants to hear. And I believe that he sincerely believed that a significant part of the Ukrainian population, maybe even the a majority, or at least half of the people in Ukraine, at least the majority of people in the eastern part of Ukraine, would either welcome or tolerate his invasion. And of course, he miscalculated very, very dramatically. But that's what happens when you are an authoritarian leader that surrounds himself with people that only provide whose only value is that they tell you what you want to hear anyway.
So I want to ask you three quick questions, Andre. One, you're head of the Ukraine chapter of Nonviolence International. Are you taking up arms as men and women? Many are just taking up arms in the streets, so even if they're just going to throw a Molotov cocktail, number one. Number two, are you shocked by this number that Ukraine is putting out of 2,000 Ukrainian civilians killed? And what do you make of those who say, I mean, that Putin was responding to the eastern expansion of NATO, that Ukraine could become a part of NATO?
Okay. Let's see. The first question is, will I take up arms? No. I'm committed to nonviolence, as you can understand from the name of our nonprofit organization, Nonviolence International. And I believe that there are very many ways in which people of Ukraine can nonviolently resist the current aggression. And in fact, this is happening in many, many locations where Russian troops have invaded. You can see on videos or reports of people protesting, people blocking roads, and people calling on soldiers to leave, and so forth and so on. And I believe that basically we see both a very strong resistance of the Ukrainian military against the invasion, but we also see a general resistance of the population. So I see my role. I'm not a Ukrainian citizen myself, so you know, it's not for me to call on people to take one or another course. But I certainly see that there is also, and we see more and more every day, we see more and more forms and very interesting ways of people that find ways to nonviolently resist ordinary people, citizens of Ukraine, that find ways to nonviolently resist the Russian invasion. So that's the first question. The second one was, could you repeat the second?
The second question is, you're surprised by the number the Ukrainian government has just put out of 2,000 Ukrainian civilians killed. They've also said that they've killed 6,000 Russian soldiers.
I've been, due to my work as a civil society activist working on peace building and humanitarian issues, I've been to a number of war zones. And in fact, what I'm seeing today in Ukraine reminds me very much of what I've seen many, many years ago in Chechnya. In fact, I was exactly half my current age then, but that was when I also saw Russian troops rolling into an area and thinking that this would be an easy, you know, operation lasting a few days, and it all turning into a bloody massacre that lasted for years. So my experience is that, of course, counts of victims in wars, especially during the events, cannot be very reliable. And figures that you hear generally tend to be greatly exaggerated. But that does not mean in any way that we're not seeing immense human suffering and large numbers of civilian casualties. There's just no way to accurately estimate the total numbers, because Ukraine is a big country. The situation is very different in different parts of the country. Military casualties, civilian casualties.
And finally, Andrei, on that issue of the pretext for the invasion, that Putin was fighting against the NATO expansion.
Well, let's say that it was actually under President Putin that Russia was seen by NATO as a ally. It was under President Putin, maybe 15, 16 years ago, that there de facto was a NATO air base, not maybe a military base, but a logistical base in near one of Russia's central cities that aided NATO operations in Afghanistan. So if Putin is so worried about NATO expansion and sees that as such a threat, then the question is, how come 15 years ago he was seen as an ally, and NATO planes were allowed to be based and refuel on Russian territory? So obviously, there's some contradiction here. Now, I should say that it is true that I believe that both NATO and the United States have, in the 90s and in the beginning of this century, have made some very serious political mistakes that, in a sense, had a effect of pushing Russia away, or maybe led to the fact that the Russian leadership began seeing NATO as a potential threat to Russia. But the reality is that I think that people in Russia, and I even think that the leadership in Russia, I don't know what's happening in the minds of Mr. Putin. I mean, obviously, he lives in a bubble, and he doesn't have proper information about what's going on. But I think that the military understands that NATO is no real threat to Russia, and that NATO will not attack, and that's why they use this more as a propaganda. It might be that Putin actually believes what he says. Again, I don't know. This is a question to his psychiatrist, if he has one. But that's today. That's not the issue. Today, we see that we see what's going on, and what's going on has to be stopped. This war has to be stopped as soon as possible.
And Andre, I just want to ask you one last question. In terms of the obviously, all nations resist people who come into their country to try to military occupations, and the Ukrainians are definitely showing an example to the world in their resistance. But I wanted to ask you about this. Decree of the Ukrainian government that men between the ages of 18 and 60 are not allowed to leave the country. Shouldn't men as well as women and children who feel that they want to get out be allowed to get out?
If you asked me, I would say yes. I think that Ukraine has no shortage of men who are voluntarily ready to fight for the freedom and independence of their nation. And if it would be up to me, I would not, it's a choice that people have to make. I don't think that it makes sense to limit. You see so many people willing to fight, probably much more than the Ukrainian military can actually include in their ranks, that I just don't think that would be necessary. But there's certain laws, there's certain procedures, and I guess in, I'm not a specialist on Ukrainian law, and I guess they have this, you know, idea that when you have a general mobilization, you shouldn't let people of certain males of a certain age group out of the country. Well, you know, can debate whether that's right or not. I wouldn't do it like that. But, you know, we have to understand that the Ukrainian government is under tremendous pressure, and, you know, it works in a very difficult situation. And we see certain steps that might, you know, we can be questionable.
Andrei Kamenchikov, we want to thank you for being with us, Ukraine Director for Nonviolence International, Regional Director of the Global Partnership for the Prevention of Armed Conflict. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The United Nations reports more than 800,000 people have fled Ukraine since Russia attacked last week, but many foreign nationals trying to escape have described racist discrimination and abuse, saying they were turned away from buses and at the border while Ukrainians were welcomed with open arms. India's government's dispatched ministers to Ukraine's border with Poland after people from India seeking to cross from Ukraine to Poland reported they were told to go to Romania instead. Citizens of several African countries report they were also pushed back from Poland because they are black. Some 16,000 African students are thought to have been studying in Ukraine. On Tuesday, Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, tweeted Russia's invasion had, quote, affected Ukrainians and non-citizens in many devastating ways, and said, quote, Africans seeking evacuation are our friends and need to have equal opportunities to return to their home countries safely. Several African governments also condemned the racism Africans in Ukraine faced while trying to escape, with the African Union calling the treatment a breach of international law. On Tuesday, Democracy Now! Reached 25-year-old Nigerian student Somto Ora after he had reached Warsaw, Poland. He described the discriminatory treatment he and other African students faced as they tried to flee, starting at the train station in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv.
The first discrimination started in Kyiv, which is the capital, at the train station. I was trying to enter, and they were telling us it's only women and children, then they were only picking white women and children. So when the first train left, the second one came and they said the same thing. We now asked them, what do you mean by women and children? Because we are not seeing you taking any black women here. If you meant white men and children, you are being honest. But telling us women and children and not taking African women along is totally rubbish. So we started shouting and started telling them, nobody is going to live here if they don't stick to their words. So they asked us, where are the African women? We started showing them the African women and children, and they were able to board. So another train that is going to Poland came in. I jumped in with other two Africans. I was in the cabin, and they called police on us. The police came and told us to get out of the train. They dragged us out and told us this train going to Poland is specifically for Ukrainians only. So we have to wait for another train that was in the night. That train came in. They told us the train is not going to Lviv, which is the city that has border with Poland. So we copied the train number and sent it to my friend. My friend also copied it and sent it to his girlfriend, who is a Ukrainian. And the girlfriend told him that this train is going to Lviv. Don't listen to them. Jump in. The train was about to leave. We jumped in. They were already trying to close the door. We told them, you either open the door or you push us on the way. So they have no other option than to open the door. So we went in. We were the only Africans in the train. When we got to Lviv, the whole train going, the first train came in and they told us it's only Ukrainians, women and children only. And they usually pick more white people than black people. We started shouting again. So when the second train came, we have to push the whole white African women and children to the front so that they were able to take them. Then we had no other option than to look for a taxi that would take us to the border. Then we got to a barricade that is 30 minutes away to the border. And the barricade told us that the soldiers there, with the police there, separated us. They said, foreigners go this side, the Ukrainians go the other side. So time was going. I asked some people there, how long have you been here? One said 3 days, the other one said 2 days. We're like, no, I cannot endure this. I have to find a way. So in the morning, which is the next day, we started protesting and telling them they have to let us go, that this is rubbish. They're taking like 100 Ukrainians and then taking like 2 Africans. It doesn't make sense because there are more Africans there than Ukrainians at the border. So we started pushing and the police cocked their guns and pointed us gun and told us that they're going to shoot us. We told them that we are students. We just want to go home. And if one person gets shot here, that we will never take it lightly. We are thousands here. I don't think all of them can kill us. The police came in and drove with speed, parked in our front, brought our gun like the soldier, and told us that they're going to shoot. We told them we don't care. We have to pass. So we started pushing over. Before we know, all of us started shouting, yay! We broke the barricade and started running across towards the border. So some of them started beating some people with baton. Meanwhile, when we were trekking to the border, Ukrainians were helping us. They were giving us food and water on the road, which is very nice. The only people that discriminated against us were the officials, that's the law enforcement officers. Then after the whole day, in the night, they started allowing the men because there are only few women left. So it was pretty easy for us to cross over, and at the Poland side, there was no discrimination. So we want to continue our education, and nobody wants to go back without completing their education. So we also want the world to know that it is actually not good to be asking the world for help while committing war crime and discriminating against Africans. It never made sense. I was expecting people at war to be more compassionate. I wasn't expecting them to do such things.
That's Nigerian student Samto Ora speaking with Democracy Now! After he fled to Poland from Ukraine and reached Warsaw. Special thanks to Democracy Now! Producer Messiah Rhodes, who reached him for this report. And for the radio listeners, you can go to democracynow.org and see the video, the B-roll that we laid over what Samto was saying. It is his own B-roll. It's his own video of what took place on his journey. Coming up, we talk about Russia's invasion and President Biden's State of the Union address with Filipino vice presidential candidate Walden Bello and Branko Marcetic of Jacobin. Stay with us. Good That Won't Come Out by Rilo Kiley. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Tuesday night, President Biden gave his first State of the Union address. He began by condemning Russian President Vladimir Putin for invading Ukraine.
Tonight, I say to the Russian oligarchs and the corrupt leaders who bilked billions of dollars off this violent regime, no more. The United States... I mean it. The United States... The Department of Justice is assembling a dedicated task force to go after the crimes of the Russian oligarchs. We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy. He has no idea what's coming.
That was President Biden delivering a State of the Union address, his first one. To talk more about his remarks and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we're joined by two guests, Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar and activist who's campaigning for vice president in the Philippines. He co-founded Focus on the Global South. He's adjunct professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Binghamton. And Branko Marcetic, staff writer, Jacobin Magazine, author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. His latest piece is headlined, Four Ways to Counter Russian Aggression That Don't Risk Nuclear War. Branko, why don't you start there? Four ways to counter Russian aggression that don't include nuclear war, and also respond to the State of the Union by Biden, who you wrote a biography of.
Well, there is right now a very jingoistic attitude that has inflamed all over the world, including the United States. And at the moment, the only solutions that are being presented as feasible ways to get to end this war and to create some sort of stability and peace in Europe are military means, whether sending weapons into Ukraine that may end up in the hands of far-right forces there, whether that means reckless calls for a no-fly zone, or even turning Ukraine into some sort of Afghanistan-like quagmire, which would be disastrous for the actual people of Ukraine. What I have tried to suggest is other ways to respond to this, to not just show the world's disapproval over this illegal and appalling invasion, but also to deter future such actions from any other states, whether it's Russia or other authoritarian countries. One of the ways that I think we need to talk about, and I was surprised that this was not mentioned in the State of the Union speech, because it is both a urgent security issue in general, but also relates directly to Putin's actions, is the need to aggressively move away from fossil fuels. The reason why the West has found it somewhat tricky to respond to Putin over the course of this crisis, and the reason why the West generally finds it difficult to respond to the various outrageous actions of countries like, say, Saudi Arabia, is because the continued reliance on fossil fuels to run our societies, to run our economies, means that we're hamstrung. We rely to a large extent on the oil and gas reserves of countries like Russia, of countries like Saudi Arabia. And so it makes it very difficult to respond to them. It also gives them relative freedom, or at least the belief that they have relative freedom to act in the world stage in a variety of illegal ways. So we really need to start talking about the need to aggressively invest in green energy. Germany has recently announced that they're going to spend more than 2% of their GDP on defense in response to this. I think that's going to be largely irrelevant, because when you're dealing with a nuclear power, there's only so much military buildup that you can have that will have an effect. They would do better, I think, to spend that money on moving their energy reliance away from fossil fuels and away from reliance on not just Russian oil and gas, but the oil and gas of every other authoritarian petrostate that we currently rely on. You know, another thing that I think both relates to this Ukrainian war, this war in Ukraine by Putin, and also the State of the Union and the pressing issues that are happening domestically in the United States, is this war is already causing a direct inflationary pressure in the United States and around the world, because oil is jumping. I know that the United States has released certain reserves of oil and gas, but nonetheless, oil prices are going up. This is going to hit ordinary people particularly hard. It's going to be bad domestically for Biden and the Democrats, who are already and were already struggling with the issue of inflation before this happened. And it won't just be oil. Ukraine is a major wheat exporter. That means that it could cause pressure on a whole host of countries' food supplies, say in the Middle East, if this war is protracted and continues to destabilize that country. So, you know, all of these were reasons why I had hoped, as this crisis was rolling through December, January, February, that what would happen in accordance with the wishes and the calls from a variety of leading foreign policy voices, including Jack Matlock, the former ambassador to the Soviet Union, that there would be a diplomatic solution before a war was started to prevent it from happening in the first place, because the war would not be good for anyone. Unfortunately, that did not happen. So I think now the task is to both avoid military escalation, avoid a wider conflict, avoid a catastrophic nuclear war, and try and get a ceasefire agreed to as soon as possible so that things can get to back to some level of relative stability.
I'd like to bring Walden Bellow into the conversation. Walden, you've been a leading analyst of the Global South. And interestingly, some key countries in the Global South have not been as united over this issue of condemning Russia in its invasion. I'm thinking specifically, for instance, the BRIC nations, Brazil, India, South Africa have declined to condemn Putin's invasion. There are Mexico's Manuel López Obrador did criticize the invasion, but has refused to participate in any economic sanctions against Russia, as well, of course, as Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, longtime enemies of the United States and Latin America, have also been muted in terms of their response to the Russian invasion. What do you make of that? And also, what's the situation with the Philippines?
Yes. Thank you, Juan and Amy, for inviting me here. I think that there is, in fact, this hesitation that you see across the board. I think, though, that a number of countries, including the Philippines, which was initially speaking about being, you know, taking a more neutral stance, have come out with a condemnation of the invasion. But beyond that, I think there will be not very much support across the Global South for more actively or proactively taking the side of the United States, which, of course, the U.S. wants to make a diplomatic win here by trying to get, you know, most of the countries in the United Nations General Assembly to condemn the invasion. So I don't think there will be many that will be ongoing from condemning the invasion, going to taking a more active role to try to isolate Russia. And that's my sense about how things are going at this point. One thing that people feel is, you know, that their national interests are not really involved in this in a major way. The second thing is they really fear that there is an agenda on the part of the U.S. that while this is an unjustified invasion, the U.S. has in fact provoked it and is trying to take advantage of it at this point in time. I think that quite a lot of people in the Global South realize that ever since the Soviet Union fell apart in 2001, NATO and the United States tried to take advantage of it in an aggressive eastward expansion of NATO right onto, you know, the countries that would border the Soviet Union, including, you know, the Ukraine. The other thing is it's not only been NATO expansion, it's also been interference, active interference in Ukrainian politics, oftentimes supporting far right-wing fascist groups within Ukraine. And the Central Intelligence Agency has indeed been very active in that sort of thing. So my sense is that one cannot discount real security fears on the part of Russia, on the part of Putin. I mean, this is almost like, you know, if Ukraine enters NATO, you're almost creating a situation in which NATO and U.S. Nuclear missiles would be right at the border of Russia, pretty much like in 1961, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The whole rationale of the U.S. for calling that seawide quarantine by Kennedy was, in fact, to say that short-range missiles would be right about 90 miles away from the United States. So that, I think that is the kind of concern and fear that you have at this point within the Russian leadership. So I would not sort of say that that is really an illusion, as one of your earlier speakers had said. That's very real. And the problem, of course, from my point of view, is that, as our friend from Jacobin said, there really could have been a diplomatic solution to this whole thing. But the U.S. was not interested in that diplomatic solution. I think what Russia probably would have been interested in pushing was creating some sort of a neutral zone of countries, bordering Russia, that would, in fact, not be hosts for NATO and its nuclear weaponry. So a diplomatic solution that could have created a neutral zone, was pretty much, I think, the rational thing to do, given the security concerns of the Russians, as well as the independence concerns of the Ukrainians. But I think the West was not interested in that. And I think while this invasion must really be condemned, I think one must also acknowledge that the U.S. has played a provocative role in this whole thing. The other thing that I would like to also stress is that, the U.S. is desperate for some credibility at this point in time, especially after the very shameful exit from Afghanistan, in which it lost a lot of credibility globally as well as within its allies in Europe. And I think one of the tragedies of this Putin's move has been to give the United States, a sort of an opportunity to try to assert that sort of superpower leadership for the West. Now, some people are saying that, hey, doesn't this sort of create a situation where China might be tempted to take over Taiwan? And that's sort of in the air, but which is, I think, pretty silly. First of all, Ukraine is not tied to the U.S. by any sort of security treaty. Taiwan is. Despite the fact that the U.S. has this contradictory policy of recognizing just one China. Secondly, U.S. military forces, are in the Taiwan Straits. They own the South China Sea. The Seventh Fleet is there all the time, so that the Chinese are not foolish enough to think that that any sort of invasion of Taiwan would be successful. The third thing is China is not interested at this point in any sort of military conflict that would jeopardize what is its big reputation right now of peaceful economic diplomacy that it has really been pushing. I mean, anything that would go in a militaristic direction, I think they would not be really provoked into. My worry, in fact, is that the United States, with its tremendous military forces surrounding China from Japan.
We have 15 seconds, Walden.
Yes. Might be the one that might begin to stoke tensions over here. That's my big worry, not about China taking over Taiwan.
We're going to have to leave it there, but this is a discussion that will continue. Also, just one slight correction. The Soviet Union breakup was in 1991. Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar and activist campaigning for vice president of the Philippines, co-founder of Focus on the Global South, and Bronco Marchetich, staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening. Human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresina, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Here's a trivia question for you. What well-known U.S. poet has a species of bat named after her?
Well-known U.S. poet has a species of bat named after her. Is this a joke or is it real?
No, it's real.
I don't know. Who?
Well, it's Nikki Giovanni.
Nikki Giovanni?
Yes. Over her long career, she earned a whole lot of awards like the Langston Hughes Medal. She was nominated for a Grammy for Best Spoken Word Album. But she also has a species of bat named after her, Micronicterus Giovannii. Because in 2004, Robert Baker, who was a biologist at Texas Tech there in Lubbock, discovered a new species of Micronicterus. And this is a bat that's also known as the leaf-nosed bat. And he was a huge fan of Nikki Giovanni. And he wrote at the time, "I decided to choose someone whose life work I respected immensely, but that I'd never had contact with. It was a way of going outside of my own world." So Robert Baker wrote to Nikki Giovanni, and he basically said, "You don't know me, and this isn't a joke, but I want to name a bat after you." And Nikki Giovanni was delighted. She told the Washington Post, "It's really cute with big ears and little eyes, and it hangs out in the rainforests of Ecuador."
Oh, yeah, I would be honored as well.
Yeah.
What a tribute to have a species named after you.
Yeah. I mean, he really felt like he was conferring a gift. You know, there are millions and millions and millions of stars, but there aren't that many animal species. So it's kind of a big deal.
And instead of naming it after himself.
Yes. To name it after a poet. I just thought that was lovely. He has her work up on his office walls. And I really love that. And I also love learning the word nose leaf. Nose hyphen leaf is that thing on these bats. It kind of looks like a little leaf. It is really cute. This little structure that may help them with echolocation.
Oh, exciting. I've always been thrilled to learn more about echolocation. I wish I could do it. Names are part of language, and this show is about language. Tell us about the names in your lives. What have you named the kids, the dog, the car, the refrigerator? 877-929-9673 or on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, welcome to Away With Words.
Thank you. I appreciate it. My name is Nancy Hasty, and I live in North Carolina.
Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
What can we do for you, Nancy?
We live in Appalachian Mountains, and we had a phrase that I grew up with, a spell. It was like, well, what is a spell? And it's like, well, you go visiting for a spell. You sit down a spell. If you're tired, you're having a sinking spell. Talking about the weather, you might have a dry spell or a wet spell. And it wasn't any definite period of time, but growing up, we just kind of knew what a spell was. And I was just curious about that because spell doesn't have anything to do with spelling a word.
Yeah, we're talking about the word S-P-E-L-L, spell. And as you said, it's completely different from the spell meaning to put together letters to form a word. It's different from the spell in Spelling Bee or to cast a spell on somebody. That the spell that you're talking about, a period of time, is an entirely different word.